So yeah, these are the authors of Reach Everyone, Teach Everyone. It's a really great book. As you're looking through it, one of the things that I just strongly straight up recommend is on page 15, they make this phenomenal chart that kind of shows where you sit within education, might be what chapters are most use to you. And I would say read the whole thing. I think it's entirely useful because it also helps you skills to communicate with other people that are working around UDL. But certainly check out those chapters. And it really is a great book. I've enjoyed, I'm not done with it yet, but I've enjoyed what I've read of it. So I'm going to start off with one question for them to kind of get them rolling. And then hopefully, if as you have questions or thinking about what they're talking about in this conversation of UDL, as you have questions, I will feed that to them. Hopefully they'll be able to hear you, but if not, then I will feed it to them. So, Kirsten, you're on our screen, so I'm going to start with you.
Okay.
Can you tell us about kind of where this book came from?
Sure. So Tom and I were connected through a mutual friend, and we actually come from the different worlds in coming into this book, which I think is what something that makes it really unique. My background is in disability services in higher ed. My immediate background is in disabilities and services in higher ed, whereas Tom was doing faculty development work. And Tom, you can interrupt if you need. We both have a colleague who's in a similar space. And one of the things that we sort of found out through casual conversations is that there's a lot of overlap between the concept of accommodations for one student and actually creating that accommodation and making it a universal strategy to help more people to look at the diversity of the learners that we're seeing in our classrooms today. I started in the world of higher ed on federally funded grants, looking at universal design in higher education back when it was just starting to emerge into higher education. It sort of found its way into education through the K-12 system. And then I was traveling sort of around New England and sort of talking to other schools and saying, here's a way that you could positively impact a wider range of learners through offering different strategies and diversifying the way in which we teach, the way in which we come to a class, we appreciate a topic, and how we assess. And I was getting a lot of, that's a really great idea, but the specifics are tricky. Each university has its own culture, its own political structure, its own resources. And so for me, I needed to get into a university to really understand the background about how university worked. And in doing so, I met our shared colleague, and she was working with faculty to help faculty understand better ways of teaching. And I was coming at it from I need faculty to understand how to support students with disabilities space. And together, it was a really nice marriage of how do we work with faculty together to benefit not only my students with disabilities, but also really any student in the classroom, because no two learner learns alike. And she introduced me to Tom, and we've had a really incredible journey since then.
Awesome. Tom?
And Kirsten is putting her finger on something that's really powerful, and that is I didn't come from a disability services background, and we are each other's best editors. We bounce ideas off one another. I call it UDL, and she calls it UD. So, you know, the whole book is suffused with that multiplicity of perspectives. I started out, like many of you folks, as a professor. I was a 19th century English literature person. And I got hired on by a two-year college in my area that I was living at the time, 20-something years ago. And they wanted me to help them create online programs. This was the late 1990s. Things were just getting started up. I helped them to adopt Blackboard version 1.0. So you can tell all that gray hair, I've earned all of that. And I met one of my colleagues named Marty. He had gone blind due to complications from undiagnosed and untreated diabetes in his 40s. He wanted to teach online. I helped him do it, but in so doing, I violated privacy laws 6 different ways because we were throwing graduate students into his course to act as his eyes and ears. And it was that moment where I looked around and I thought, okay, if it was that hard for me to help one person, who are the other people whom we're really not reaching out to? And I started to see people with work responsibilities, family responsibilities, military deployed learners, rural learners who just lived a long distance away from campus. And that really got me thinking about how can we lower barriers for everybody? And that really led to the book.
Awesome. Thank you very much. Does anybody like to ask some questions? Oh, they're throwing up hands left and right.
Yes. Teaching the millennium generation fits into
universal college? Sure. So Tom, the question is, how does teaching the millennial generation fit into universal design for learning?
The question about the millennial generation, it's almost a red herring, I want to say. One of our big challenges is that we think that the youngest generation of our students learns in a different way, or they approach learning differently. And from the neuroscience, we know that that is not actually true. What we do see to be true, and this also applies to me as a Gen Xer and to adult learners everywhere, is that culturally, we have shifted the way that we interact with information. And that's one of the key takeaways from the book, is that when we think about the interactions that we have with our learners, think about the courses you teach, chances are the way in which you interact with your students, the most satisfying moments of your classes are when you can have that Socratic dialogue with them, where you can give them an opportunity to experiment, maybe fail at a few things, be there as a guide for them, and then help them to move from stage to stage to stage in the content of your course. When we think about the millennial generation, that's often shorthand for I always am looking at my phone. And that's actually a really good analog for universal design for learning. When we think about UDL, one of the mistakes we can make is thinking it applies only to students with disabilities. And Kirsten and I have come up with the idea that if we start thinking about our learners and their phones, that that's a really interesting way to start thinking about how we do outreach beyond just the classroom or even beyond the online interactions that we have in our online courses. So think about it this way. Think about the single father who has to drop his daughter off at school and then has to drive 45 minutes back across town to get to work. Well, during those 45 minutes, if that father had a way that he could get the PDF or the Microsoft Word document of some reading that you wanted him to do for class, and he could have his phone send that by Bluetooth to the speakers in his car and have it read out to him. And by the way, there's hundreds of free apps on Google Play Store and the iTunes Store that will do just that. If he could get that time, that 45-minute commute, and actually listen to the article that you want him to read, he'll come to class better prepared. And that's what we're all about with Universal Design for Learning. Looking at ways that we can reach out to students and give them just 20 more minutes in their day. And that can be the difference between I'm struggling and I'm keeping up. UDL is a lot more than that, but it's a way to start thinking about it. So good question.
Excellent. And Kirsten, thoughts?
Yeah, I agree completely with Tom on that. I think that, you know, this generation neurologically is very similar, but I think what's interesting, and I heard a really interesting talk on this the other day, is that the attention span is much shorter because there's so much competing for attention. So if we can find those extra 20 minutes for students to spend a little time in a way in which they can, you know, really understand and personalize the course learning experience, that's what we're looking to try to do in an age when there's so much competing for our attention. And I think universal design really allows us to think creatively, to meet the students where they're at, and in a lot of cases, allow the students to sort of direct where they may learn, what they might do. By offering a little bit of flexibility, students have the ability to choose when and where and how they're going to manipulate and work with the content. And that really goes to owning the material, not just memorizing it and regurgitating it.
Awesome. Thank you both very much. Other questions? Oh, up and back.
Thank you so much for us over the video. And I didn't get a chance to hear you again, but I I guess in general, how do you draw the line between feasible and reasonable?
So just to recap for Kirsten and Tom, first of all, it was a very gracious thank you for being here. And then the question is, how do you draw or identify between reasonable and unreasonable accommodations? And Kirsten, do you want to start with this one?
Yeah, great question. I don't know that we have a full day to discuss. So I feel you. Reasonable and unreasonable. So how do we figure that out? Well, I think what's the beauty of disability services in higher ed? It's a very strong partnership or collaboration, I suppose, between the disability services office, the faculty as the expert of content, and to some degree, the student. So disability services can determine whether or not a student has a disability and then make suggested recommendations for accommodations. But we are not content experts, so we can't demand that a faculty member has to do a certain accommodation. Especially, and this is the key here, if the accommodation might fundamentally alter the nature of the course. Okay, so when we think about the goals and objectives that we're working towards that we want our students to walk away from, if the accommodation in some way fundamentally alters it, then it is absolutely not reasonable. And in that case, it's a collaborative conversation with the disability support provider saying, look, this student, for example, a common one that we're all navigating now is students are saying, I can't always go to class, so I'd like to, you know, sort of have no absence penalties. And faculty that I work with will say, you know, you can't understand the content if you're not in class. So we have to come to a creative way of both supporting the student and also making sure that the faculty and the material that they're teaching is protected. And the student can then, in some cases, it may be that this class is not appropriate for the student at this particular time as they're navigating whatever that they're navigating. So reasonable for us, the way in which we look at that is, will the accommodation work within a class setting and not fundamentally alter the nature of the course?
Do you mind if I follow up a little bit here too?
Absolutely, go for it.
Let's flip that coin completely around, though, because when we're talking about reasonable versus not reasonable accommodation, everybody in the room, I imagine, has had the experience of having the student come with that piece of paper and saying, please make a change for me, right, based on some disability or some barrier in their lives. Let's completely flip that coin around, because UDL is not about making accommodations. Accommodations are making one change, one time, for one person. And it's horribly resource intensive. It's always work that we don't see coming because that piece of paper shows up as a surprise, right? We can't plan for that. It feels like extra work. And, you know, you would never say this out loud to a student, but some people think, hey, is this student trying to game the system? Or does this student really have a disability? Or I'm not a disability person. How can I tell, you know, what I should do with a student with disabilities? So what we advocate for with Universal Design for Learning, UDL is not making one change one time for one person. It is thinking ahead about how we design the interactions that we have ahead of time so that fewer people will have to come to us with the piece of paper. Think for a minute. Let's do a real quick thought experiment. Can anybody in the room, and I'm going to ask Lance to be my ears here, can anybody in the room think right off the bat of the topic that your students in a particular course get wrong as a class every single time you teach the class and you end up having to reteach it?
Oh, yeah. We've got some hands.
Oh, shout them out. What are those topics?
Citing sources.
Citing sources.
Okay, so citing sources. I hear that.
Good one.
Culture.
Defining culture.
Ooh, defining culture. Good.
Part of the conversation we had earlier.
Operational definitions.
Ooh, yeah. Okay. So what I'm hearing is that these kinds of examples, to continue the thought example, are there some topics that students just, they email you 700 times? Hey, I don't understand how to do this or what you want or what you're after or what the textbook is telling me. You can think of those examples too, right?
Yep.
Okay. So if those are the pain points in your course, those are excellent places to do a little UDL, to do a little universal design for learning. Think not only about how can you give people information in more than one way. That's what we talk about UDL as just plus one thinking. If there's one way to have an interaction, just give them one more way. Give them some choice. And it's the very act of having a choice as a learner that means your students are more likely to persist with you from day one till the end of the class, to be retained and take more classes next semester, and to be satisfied with their experience in your class. It also saves you an awful lot of work, right? That topic where your students always get things wrong on the test, that's a great way to create a little video or make a PDF study guide or do something different from what you already do in addition that would help your students better to prepare in a different way. But it's also, in addition to making alternatives to materials, helping them stay engaged in more than one way. Can you help them with a real-world example where they can try it out? Or giving them more than one way to demonstrate their skills instead of asking them for the 3-page to 5-page MLA citation essay. Give them an opportunity to do an audio podcast that has the same information in it, and you could grade it the same way. And that's a really good place to start with UDL. Where do you find those pain points in your course? Start there. You can start small, do an experiment, and see if it works for you.
If I could just add one thing to that, because I think Tom really hit the nail on the head with sort of our pain points. From the, again, I think circling back to the question about reasonable accommodations, from our world and from the disability service provider world, we love the concept of universal design because, as Tom pointed out, it saves us a lot of work. So, selfishly, I think it's a wonderful idea. And as Tom noted, that sometimes, students don't have to turn in their accommodation letters by a specific point in time. So you can be caught off guard even up to the last week of school. And I'm sure a few of you have received those, I need exam accommodations 3 days before the final exam letter. One of the things that we love is the idea of naturally building in this flexibility. So a common example I like to note is something that is very cost heavy and time prohibitive for a disability office is the concept of a note taker, a peer note taker for the class. So some student comes in and identifies as struggling with notes. And so they ask us to go and to find somebody as a volunteer, or maybe we spend some money. And it's a really labor intensive process. The point is, though, and I'm sure all of you can remember back to your collegiate experiences, we're not always good at taking notes. Maybe we had a flat tire on the way to school and we're worried and thinking through that instead of it listening tensely in the class. Or maybe we're just struggling with, I sprained my thumb and can't take good notes that particular day. Or I just don't necessarily grasp the information if I'm writing and listening at the same time. So by simply, asking somebody in the class, and I've seen different models of this happen where the faculty might say, okay, can somebody be our volunteer person today? We'll just post the notes online afterwards. Then everybody has access to information, and it's supplemental, of course, to their own learning experience. But what that does is it enhances everybody's ability to learn because they can get the information at a later point in time, regardless of whatever was going on in their personal life at that particular class period.
Awesome. Thank you. And I just want to make two connections here. Those pain points, that would be a great opportunity for leveling open pedagogy and creating allowing for assignments where they're creating additional resources for the course. Maybe you have students creating some of those pain points. How do they think would be a better or effective or more meaningful way for them to learn that particular pain point? And then the other piece is kind of what Kirsten was just talking about, this idea of doing like a collective notebook as I've put out there for the beginning of this session. That could be another way in which kind of you pool the information, or you kind of pool the people that are willing to contribute their notes, so that, again, it's not just you as the instructor can get good feedback, but students can also pick up from one another things that they may not have realized or may not have been able to frame as effectively. So we have time for one more question. And I thought I saw a hand up, but nope.
No, it was just kind of a statement. I was thinking that the basically UDL is just a assuming everybody has a disability without that piece of paper, whichever, and trying to reach everybody as a group, especially in lectures, but on my understanding.
So it would be, I think UDL assumes that we all have the potential to have a disability because there's temporary and there's permanent. And also, you know, regardless of that, there are ways in which just us as individuals may find one method useful over another. And if those options are both available, it behooves us to be able to take advantage of that.
There's one powerful thing that we can say to wrap up here, and that is when we think about disability, a lot of us think about disability as a medical model, that the disability is somehow inherent in the bodies of people who are disabled. The better way to think about that is a social model of disability. And what that does is instead of the disability being inside us, the disability exists in our environments. So imagine there's a building that has a set of stairs to get into the front door. Somebody in a wheelchair can't get in there. Where's the disability? It's in the environment. The building is not designed to allow somebody to just roll up a ramp and come in. And so in the 1960s, the universal design movement in the built environment started to say, why don't we just design all of our buildings so that it doesn't matter whether you're on crutches because you broke your foot, whether you're in a wheelchair permanently or temporarily, but let's just design the environment so the greatest number of people can use it without having to ask for something special. And so by situating disability in the environment, it's a really good way to look at how we design our courses as well and the interactions that we have in the library, at the registrar's office, all those kinds of things. Can we give people choices about how they path their way through their learning with us so that fewer of them will have to say, please treat me differently, I have to make a special request? And that's what UDL is really all about, and we hope you enjoy the book. I'll turn it over to Kirsten for some last comments here too.
Thanks, Tom. I agree completely. And it's a really important distinction to make between the medical and the social model. The other thing I would just sort of second is as we change the way in which we teach going forward and the method of access, I think it's important to not to also consider sort of the online environment. We pay attention to this in the book too, is that, you know, as we're developing an online space, whether it's a hybrid model, it's a fully online course, or we're using that to supplement the materials that we're teaching in class, it's important to think about universal design in those spaces as well. And you can think of, I'm sure, a whole bunch of reasons why that environment can be a disabling environment for anybody. You think of like bandwidth, and we think of, you know, just access to technology, these types of spaces. I hope that and when you leave today, and I'm not sure the examples that Lance has already given you, you'll start to notice some UD and UDL examples just in your daily life. One of my most favorite examples is closed captioning, which is a accommodation designed for a specific group of people with a specific disability. And yet the deaf and hard of hearing are far down on the list in terms of the percentage of people actually using closed captioning. You might see it in, you might use it when you're watching a foreign film. You might see it if you're going out to dinner, or if you're at the gym, or if you're traveling in the airport. But these are examples of an accommodation that was designed for a specific group of people that is actually used by a much, much larger population. And I hope as you navigate your experiences through the rest of the day and the rest of the week, you start to sort of say, oh, wow, that is something that I really use a lot of, but I would not have thought of it as a universal design strategy. And then you can, it's such a wonderful aha moment when you have those experiences, because I think it helps us to appreciate the diversity around us and also the diversity of who we're teaching. And it really makes, I find it to really make teaching a lot of fun, because my students are engaged in a new way. They're producing materials that I never would have imagined. And then I think, as Lance said earlier, I kind of use that going forward to help new students figure out ways of engaging with the material that means something to them.
Awesome. Thank you very much. Can we get a round of applause for that? thank you again. I'll be following up with more thanks, but really appreciate it. And I look forward to hearing more from both of you. Have a great day and thanks.
Thanks for having us. Enjoy.
Take care. Thank you.